This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of August 14th, here are a few top stories. Tensions have flared across the country after protests in Charlottesville, Virginia, turned violent. Here in Arizona, a Confederate monument was tarred and feathered in Apache Junction. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Jimmy Jenkins reports.
Along the Superstition Freeway at East Peralta Road, there's a stoplight and a small monument surrounded by railroad ties.
The face of the monument is covered in white feathers and black tar, melting together in the sun.
According to a member of the Sons of the Confederate Veterans, the monument was created by the Daughters of the Confederacy to commemorate Jefferson Davis and moved to its current location in 1962. John Rogers says his group sometimes maintains the monument, but they'll wait until after President Trump's appearance in Phoenix on Tuesday to restore it.
Because at this point, if we went out and cleaned it up, it would just draw attention to it.
Rogers says the group honors its ancestors who fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War. The Department of Public Safety visited the site Thursday. A spokesperson said DPS is in the early stages of an investigation. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Apache Junction.
And now, here's a segment from KJZZ's original production, The Show. Here is producer Sarah Ventry.
Whenever someone asks me, who are some famous musicians from Arizona? Chances are I'll say Jesse Coulter, Jimmy Eat World, or Linda Ronstadt. Oh, and of course the Gin Blossoms.
Tell me, did you think it'd be all right if I could just crash here tonight?
To be recognized by your peers where you came up, maybe the greatest honor.
Jesse Valenzuela is the guitarist for the Gin Blossoms, a band that is credited with helping to create what was, at one time, known as the Tempe sound. For many people, this sound, often called jangle pop, is synonymous with Arizona. Valenzuela says that for him, the music goes beyond that, but he remembers his salad days fondly.
Nobody had a car, we had a band van. And I remember we would all go grocery shopping on Mondays, because we always worked Tuesdays through Saturdays and had Sundays and Mondays off. There just wasn't a worry in the world.
Next on the docket of inductees is Nils Lofgren, known for his solo work and also for playing guitar with other powerhouses, like Bruce Springsteen and Neil Young.
Southern man, better keep your head.
While Lofgren didn't grow up in Arizona, he spent the last two decades of his almost 50-year career here in the Valley. He feels a deep connection to Arizona, but doesn't necessarily see his music as rooted in just one place.
That's kind of more of an internal spiritual inspiration that can happen anywhere. And you know, to take a seed of a song or an idea or be inspired working with others, you kind of get carried away by the musical creation, regardless of where you are.
Lofgren's induction is one he seems proud of, though he's overwhelmingly humble. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014 for his role in Springsteen's E Street Band. So how did he wind up in Arizona? Well, he fell in love with a woman in Arizona named Amy. He first met her when he was playing at the Stone Pony in Asbury Park.
She wasn't there to see me, but we visited and I tried to get her to go to Boston at 6 a.m.
It didn't work.
And then 21 years ago at the Rockin' Horse after a show, she walked up and said, "Hi, remember me?" We started dating and that led to 21 years here.
This is a right away letter. I gotta mail it today.
Mark Myers is the president of the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame. He says this particular induction ceremony is unique.
So this will be the first time we've had three inductees of their stature actually play music at their induction. And let's not leave out the Celebrity Theater.
That's right. The theater itself is being inducted.
It's been here since the 60s. Everything from Broadway plays and musicals to classical to jazz to contemporary and boxing.
The final act to be inducted is the Meat Puppets. The group's music is sometimes called cowpunk.
There's no reason not to think of all this stuff that's come out of here, and I'm pleased that they're getting down to, you know, our little scene.
That's bassist Chris Kirkwood, and that little scene is full of depth. The Meat Puppets reached their own level of success in the gritty style of music they helped carve out, but they also played a pivotal role in influencing grunge giants. Here's the band's song Plateau, covered by Nirvana.
Many a hand has scaled the grand old face of the plateau.
If you're not as familiar with the Meat Puppets, you might not hear their wide variety of influences. Here's Kirkwood.
The company that will be in there with us, cool as well, from like Marty Robbins, you know, and Wallace and Ladmo. I mean, you know, if I'm going to be in a Hall of Fame, it definitely tickles me to be in there with Wallboy and Ladmo.
But it wasn't just Wallace and Ladmo that left an indelible mark on the band's members.
I don't know. I've just kind of always seen Phoenix as kind of, you know, just kind of the a mutt of a city. And in particular, it's in the desert, in particular the Sonoran Desert, you know, it let us develop our own sound in a way. And it was certainly our, like, you know, our little psychedelic laboratory.
Some things will never change.
Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Phoenix. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In the world of business news, the U.S. solar industry is booming. Twice as much solar was installed last year as in 2015, but some say not everyone has reaped the benefits. Earlier this week, the U.S. International Trade Commission heard arguments that cheap solar imports have devastated manufacturing jobs. The case could have huge implications for the industry, KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
So here we are in our warehouse.
Before a solar project, Mark Holohan usually gives his customers plenty of time to mull over the cost. Except lately, with this trade case, that's been difficult.
We have a sort of a panic buying mode in the marketplace right now. Inventories have fallen, prices have risen.
Meaning his installation company, Wilson Electric, based near Phoenix, can't hold prices too long. Solar panels are flying off the shelves.
We used to have product that was sitting in warehouses that could be shipped in a shorter amount of time. Now we're waiting for another batch to be manufactured.
Like many installers, Holohan has relied on a cheap, plentiful supply of solar panels made overseas, mostly Asia. But this supply and demand situation may soon be upended.
There's a threat of a very large price hike looming if the total request on the trade case is granted. And so that makes life very difficult for us.
An existential threat. That's how the industry group describes this trade case, warning it could result in the loss of nearly a third of all solar jobs next year. But the two U.S. makers of panels bringing the complaint argue the opposite. They claim the glut of inexpensive imports has dealt them serious injury, and that trade protections would add jobs, more than 140,000.
If you lose the manufacturing, then all of the innovation, all of the know-how, all of the investment will go overseas.
Attorney Tim Brightbill represents SolarWorld, one of the companies requesting steep tariffs on certain solar imports. He argues without a trade barrier, U.S. manufacturers of solar panels
can't compete with foreign governments, foreign dumping and subsidies, and a global surge of imports. And they shouldn't have to.
In fact, Brightbill says SolarWorld successfully pushed for tariffs on Chinese imports before. But those safeguards haven't solved the problem. That's why they're turning to what's known as Section 201. Their case would apply to imports of certain solar products from anywhere in the world. Aaron Felmuth is a professor of international law at Arizona State University.
It's classic bad politics, right? It's a short-term fix that ignores the long-term problem.
And the final arbiter of this case could be President Donald Trump. Felmuth says, given his criticism of NAFTA, support for U.S. manufacturing, and fossil fuels,
I don't see any incentive for him, based on his past positions, to oppose a safeguard measure.
But Felmuth predicts that move may backfire.
There is no example in history of an industry that has prospered in the long run thanks to a safeguard measure.
Consumers will pay more for solar, he says, and other sectors of solar manufacturing could suffer. Companies like QuickMount PV, which is based in California and makes equipment to mount solar panels. Jeff Spees is head of policy there.
If the intention is to defend U.S. manufacturing, the decision is clear. Dismiss this case with no penalties.
He says the solar supply chain already has tens of thousands of existing manufacturing jobs. But those are at risk, along with all the other kinds of jobs, like installation.
I can't even think of anything that comes close to the threat that we see with this particular trade case. 90,000 jobs lost in any other industry would have lot of politicians freaking out.
That's finally happening. A coalition of senators from California to Kansas recently came out against any trade protections, as did a number of conservative free market groups like the Heritage Foundation. What makes this trade case especially infuriating to many in the solar industry? The two companies asking for the tariff aren't even all American. A German company, which recently declared insolvency, owns SolarWorld, and the other, Suniva, founded in Georgia, recently went bankrupt. It's owned by a Chinese firm. Mark Holohan of Wilson Electric shakes his head.
Well, they have manufacturing here. They aren't even headquartered here. So it's definitely a world market we're dealing with.
Regulators will rule by mid-September whether that globalized market has actually hurt the domestic industry. And if the answer is yes, President Trump will decide the remedy. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Is Arizona's Mexican-American Studies ban unconstitutional? After a trial in July, a federal judge is expected to weigh in on that question soon. From KJZZ's Education Desk, Carrie Young takes a closer look at how we got to this point and how this high school program became a political flashpoint.
In the late 90s, the Tucson Unified School District launched its Mexican-American Studies program in an effort to close an achievement gap among minority students. The elective programming included classes in Mexican-American literature and history.
It was one of the most fruitful times as an educator that one could even ever imagine.
Dr. Curtis Acosta is a former TUSD high school teacher.
Every year, I would consistently get some students saying, this is it, this is my last chance, I'm giving school. So they were doing it out of kind of a blind faith that maybe something about their culture or themselves was going to be something different.
Acosta was there when the district developed the curriculum and later taught it. He also says the impact he saw in students was dramatic.
Their attendance rates were through the roof, and they were coming to school, and they were doing just superbly.
Those observations were later supported by a more scientific University of Arizona study. But not everyone believed this program was good for students. John Hoopenthal is a former state lawmaker. He also served as the superintendent of public instruction from 2011 to 2015.
The legislature and the Tucson community was just getting a lot of feedback that things were not right in those classes.
Some Arizona Republicans, including Hoopenthal, say teachers in Tucson's Mexican-American Studies program were breeding resentment against whites. Citing a time he visited a class, Hoopenthal says he heard the instructor describe Benjamin Franklin as a racist.
The idea that you're going to racemize the classroom, that you're going to create a construct where Caucasians are the oppressors and Hispanics are the oppressed, and you teach them that history is oppression of minorities by Caucasians, which just simply isn't true.
The situation originally hit a flashpoint around 2006. In an open letter to the citizens of Tucson, Tom Horn, who was the superintendent of public instruction at that time, recounted a situation at the Tucson High Magnet School, where students protested and walked out on a speech by Horn's deputy. She visited the school to refute allegations made at the school earlier in the year that Republicans hate Latinos. In his letter, Horn said he believed the students learned what he called rude behavior from their Mexican-American studies teachers. Horn later used the example when testifying before the House Education Committee in 2010, when HB 2281 was first introduced.
This is one of my most profound objections to this program. If students are taught that the way to deal with disagreement is to be rude in the way that I observed, they will be unsuccessful adults.
HB 2281 prohibits programs that, quote, promote resentment toward a race or class of people and, quote, advocate ethnic solidarity instead of treatment of pupils as individuals, end quote. It was ultimately signed into law. And while there were other types of ethnic studies courses in the state, TUSD's Mexican-American Studies program was the only one found to be in violation. The school board voted to shut it down in early 2012 to avoid losing millions of dollars in state funding. The PBS NewsHour collected this tape of the protests that erupted during the process.
Our education's under attack! What do we do?
But that wasn't the end of this story. Some students and teachers later filed a lawsuit claiming the law was unconstitutional and discriminatory. And while the courts have upheld HB 2281, an appeals court ultimately sent it back to district court for a full trial to discern whether the lawmakers who created it were motivated by racial discrimination. That decision is expected soon. And while we don't know yet what the results will be, many argue the lasting impact of this highly publicized fight is clear. In Los Angeles, ethnic studies is now a required course, And some school districts in states like Texas, Nevada, New Mexico, and Washington have also made similar courses available to their high school students. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Conversations began this week between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. The American Trade Representative said the agreement has been unfair to the U.S. Some clash with that view, but others partially agree. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
The American government insisted NAFTA is unfair as a result of trade deficits. This means Americans buy more from its counterparts than otherwise. But the Mexican and Canadian delegations disagree. They say the deficit does not impact a continuously growing economy of the region. Eric Lee is the director of the North American Research Partnership, a think tank based in Arizona. He thinks the deficit argument is merely political, but agrees that not everyone has fully benefited from NAFTA.
Border communities in particular tend to be some of the poorest communities in the United States. If you take San Diego out of the picture, and definitely talking about South Texas and even some Arizona border communities.
Lee thinks NAFTA has functioned overall, as trade between the three parties has increased five times since it was first signed. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
School's in session for most children here in Arizona, but for a preteen in middle school, psychologists warn these first few weeks can be extremely stressful, socially and academically. KJZZ's Holiday Moore takes a look at what it's like fitting in when you're a kid with a cognitive disability few understand.
It's third hour at Western Sky Middle School in Goodyear.
Are you nervous?
It's a critical transition time, not only academically, but socially and emotionally as well. So imagine what it's like to be among the two children in each classroom, estimated by the Center for Disease Control to be suffering with a mental health disorder, like Tourette's.
I'm Alexandra Hill, and I'm 13 years old, and I have tics, like shake my head, roll my eyes. And vocal tics, which squeaks or accents.
His mother, Krista, came face to face with it when he started third grade.
He was going to a school in a different neighborhood, and I was tucking him in at night, and he said, "I'm not like the other kids." And that's when I knew something was going on.
Until recently, doctors prescribed medication to try and control the tics.
It gave me really bad anxiety.
This summer, they turned to neurologist Dr. David Sprecher at Banner Sun Health to try comprehensive behavioral intervention, a non-prescription therapy allowing Xander to redirect his own behavior. On this visit, Xander is singularly focused on a box filled with toys while experiencing a round of tics.
When people repeat themselves or others, we call it palilalia or echolalia, and that can get people into trouble.
Do you feel like it's coming on when it starts to hit? It just happens, really. I can't really detect it.
It's actually a lot more common than we thought. It affects about 4.5 boys for every one girl that has it.
Dr. Sprecher estimates about one in every 100 middle school students suffer from full-on Tourette's, where there are vocal and physical tics. He suspects there are many more undiagnosed when you consider milder symptoms.
The motor or the vocal alone, it may be as many as 3% or more of children.
Their symptoms are often masked by another psychiatric condition.
Attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, sensory processing, obsessive compulsive disorder, and then depression, anxiety, temper tantrums.
Keep in mind, the CDC found the more cognitive disabilities are present in children ages 12 to 17, the more vulnerable they are to suicide.
I have to shout for him to hear me, so then he gets a little frustrated.
But then he gets a little frustrated.
There you have it.
Like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is that something you do several times a day? Echo other people?
People, I don't know what they would do to me if I did it, so I try to suppress as much as I can. But I know my parents understand.
All right. Do we have a door?
In his language arts class, Xander's classmates know what to expect.
Whenever he gets angry, sometimes he'll like shout out or something, and so I can go over and talk to him and be like, "It's okay, you have time to do this now. Work on it now and we can talk later. And
part of the reason is Krista went on the offense to find support for Tourette's.
I am the chairperson of the Arizona chapter for the Tourette Association of America.
She set out to educate herself and the school.
We wanted to educate the whole sixth grade population because a lot of the kids were coming from different elementary schools and weren't familiar with Zanders.
Schools saw it as an opportunity to talk about the struggles all kids face with cognitive disorders. Talking to classmates, they're enlightened.
I'm Jackson Hamblin. I'm from seventh grade at Western Sky Middle School. I found out this year that he had Tourette's.
He says he'd heard what other kids thought about the disorder.
Kids say that Tourette's makes you weird, and then that's what the fidget cubes are for, and I think it's really rude.
So does Xander's longtime friend, Amanda Huesma.
They shouldn't make fun of someone for something they can't do anything about. It's like saying, hey, your eyes are weird when you can't change them.
Things have come a long way. There's been a lot of work over decades through advocacy groups like Tourette Association of America to raise awareness.
You know, educating people is key to acceptance, whether they be in a wheelchair or a cognitive disability.
Your job to make sure that everybody in the group is being encouraged and supported in answering the questions.
Because I'm just a normal kid who wants to fit in.
Holiday Moore, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.